It's Diane. On my mind, cyber attacks hit American companies. In May, Colonial Pipeline was the target of a ransomware attack, which shut down their operations. The results were panic and widespread gas shortages in the Southeast U.S. In response, the company paid millions in cryptocurrency, which the Justice Department says has been recovered. But this tactic is being replicated as groups look to expose vulnerable but vital industries and hold them hostage in exchange for payment. To help us understand what's happening and what the government and the companies themselves can do to protect against attacks, I spoke with April Falcon Doss, Executive Director of the Institute for Technology Law and Policy at the Georgetown University Center of Law. April, tell me what kinds of attacks, cyber attacks, we're seeing right now.
We are seeing an unusually widespread range of kinds and an unusually high volume of attacks. So we are seeing ransomware attacks that shut down access to systems and data by encrypting it. Those are like the Colonial Pipeline attack we saw that restricted gas supply up and down the East Coast. We are seeing business email compromise attacks where hackers get in the middle of a communication and try to fool somebody into wiring funds to a fraudulent account. For instance, by saying to a vendor, you know that outstanding invoice that you owe me payment on, here's new wiring instructions, send it over here instead. We're certainly still seeing phishing attacks where people's email logins and other kind of credentials are compromised. And then once the hackers are into a system, they can exfiltrate data, which might include payment card information or health data or other kinds of sensitive data. We are seeing cyber attacks on research institutions that are aimed at getting sensitive intellectual property. We are seeing cyber attacks like the SolarWinds attack, which was what's often referred to as a supply chain attack, where software that's widely used by other companies was compromised by injecting malware into software. So as people updated their systems, they uploaded malware that then let the hackers get a toehold and carry out other malicious activity. And we're seeing cyber attacks that involve things like the Microsoft Exchange attack, which was a different way of approaching big infrastructure by inserting these web shells or malicious bits of code that would allow attackers to get access to anybody who used an unprotected version of the very popular, widely used Microsoft Exchange email server. So the short answer is that we are seeing a wide range of techniques, we are seeing a wide range of targets, and we are seeing this constantly changing landscape where these attacks are directed at government entities at the state, local, and federal level, at private companies in every industry you can imagine, at individuals. I mean, it really has been, frankly, it's been off the charts.
So some of these cyber attacks are asking for money, and some of these cyber attacks are after information. What are their techniques? They simply go in and plant this malware and somebody clicks on it?
Well, it varies. So you're absolutely right. The two main forms, if you will, of attack are either seeking to get information, usually because it can be used for intelligence purposes or competitive advantage or for identity fraud and theft, or seeking to directly extort money from people. And that's what we see in the ransomware and the business email compromise attacks. What's interesting is that in terms of techniques, both of those types of cybercrimes can be initiated through the same set of tools. So for example, you know, people are growing accustomed to hearing, if you receive an email from an address you don't recognize and it asks you to click on a link, be suspicious. Look closely at who it's from before you click on that link. The reason is because very often that link will contain some malware that will do various things. And it might be a link or it might be an attachment to an email. That malware often is designed to harvest a user's credentials. So what you or I use to log into our email account or into, say, an IT network in a work environment. Once the hackers have those login credentials, then they kind of, at their leisure, can go back and sneak into that person's account and rummage through whatever they have access to. So if you think about the analogy in the physical world, it would be as if the hackers were able to make a physical copy of your office key and then after hours go into your office, just rummage around in your desk and your file drawers. And, you know, maybe you have access to some personal information or some research information or some ability to transfer funds. But while they're there in your office, they're going to say, oh, well, I see not only does Diane have this information here, but she has a key to the HR office down the hall. Let me take her key to the HR office and I'll go down there and I'll rummage through their files and I'll get everybody's social security numbers. And HR has the key to the finance office where they keep all the payroll information. So I'm going to go down the hall and open that door and rummage through those files so that I can get everybody's direct deposit bank account information. So in other words, these techniques often start with some kind of toehold that is very frequently just gaining access to one user's account. And then once they get in there, they can sort of fish around within the network and see what else they can gain access to.
So their desire is to get absolutely as much information as they possibly can. And then, I mean, it is a form of blackmail that they're using.
Yeah, no question. Ransomware and business email compromise especially are absolutely a form of extortion, no question. So in terms of how these cyber criminals think about it, we see some different dynamics among different groups. For example, the Russian government has long had intelligence services that carry out cyber operations for intelligence gathering as part of, you know, geopolitics. They have long been known to allow those cyber operators to freelance on the side as cyber criminals. So the initial penetration into a network might be to find out personal information, not for profit, but for geopolitical purposes. But then on the side, that same cyber operator sells that information. If they're able to gain something like a social security number or financial account information, medical records, those things can be sold on the dark web to people who will purchase it in order to carry out identity fraud and identity theft and other kinds of secondary financial crimes, if you will. So that's one way of monetizing information. And then the really big shift that we've seen in just the past 5 to 10 years is that as cryptocurrencies have become more widely available throughout the world and they're highly unregulated, sometimes what hackers do is say, you know, rather than get information that I can sell, what I'll do is I'll just go into somebody's system, I'll lock up their computers, I'll lock up all their files, and I will tell them unless they pay me some money, I'm going to delete their stuff. I'm going to release their sensitive information. I'm going to do some other kind of damage to their files and systems, and they won't be able to get back into their computers. Sometimes the victims of those ransomware attacks are able to restore information from backups. Sometimes they can recover from the attack without paying. But because cryptocurrency makes it so easy for criminals to receive money into accounts that aren't associated with their true name, it has created this opportunity for cybercrime to go from selling stolen information to now just extorting people for money in order to get access to their own systems back.
And that's why I'm so amazed that apparently the Justice Department was able to, this week, get back some of that cryptocurrency. How were they able to do that?
Boy, that is the $2.3 million question that everybody's asking. So the FBI is keeping mum about what precise investigative techniques they used. Not surprising that they would do that. Here's what we do know. The way cryptocurrencies work, there is an account that is based on a what's called a public key, a public cryptography key, and that account is just a long string of characters. And you can see every transaction that's made. But you don't know who owns that account, and you also don't know what the private key is. And the private key is kind of like the combination to unlock the safety deposit box, right? And so unless you have the private key, you can't access the funds. So what we know from the affidavit that the FBI filed when they got the search warrant to seize the ransom money is that the FBI was somehow able to get access to this private key, which functions a lot like a password or like that combination to the safe deposit box. Once they had that private key, then they could go to the court and say, aha, we know how to access these funds. We're confident that they're fruits of a crime. And so because this was a violation of computer crime laws, we would like to seize these assets. There's a number of ways they might have gotten the private key. And again, they're keeping quiet about what exact techniques they used. But this is really an attention getter, both for victims who are now going to have new hope that perhaps the government can help them recover some of the ransomed funds, and also for cyber criminals who might say, well, if the FBI is able to repeat this, maybe this is not going to be as lucrative an endeavor as we thought.
So who do we think are doing this cyber hacking, cyber ransom? Who's doing it?
Almost everybody.
That's what I wondered. I mean, we've been talking about the Russians, we've been talking about the Chinese, but more and more people have gotten into this, have they not?
They have. And that has really been, again, especially over the last 5 years, 5 to 10, but really with an increasing pace. What's happened is that hacker tools of all kinds have become widely available on the internet. And that includes ransomware tools. And so, in fact, the term that gets used in the cybersecurity community these days is ransomware as a service, which literally means that criminal syndicates like DarkSide, who are believed to have been behind the Colonial Pipeline attack, will say on the internet, if you want to use our ransomware tools, let us know. They enter into an agreement with their customer. They take a 15% cut of all the proceeds. They talk with their customer, the other criminal, about who they want to target and how, and come up with, you know, sort of targeted campaigns. This is big business. And what makes it possible in part is the fact that it's possible to have this really unregulated and unscrutinized money flowing around the world. Certainly one of the things that is catching people's attention in this context is whether and how cryptocurrency can be brought within some set of regulations that is more similar to traditional banking.
So at this point, companies who are finding themselves vulnerable, like Colonial Pipeline or JBS Meat, they've been vulnerable because their protective devices have not been sufficiently secure. Is that why the hackers were able to get in?
Well, again, it depends. And so sometimes it's an issue relating to devices, sometimes it's an issue relating to software, sometimes it's an issue relating to human error. And so, you know, we've talked a lot about phishing attacks and things like that. When somebody clicks on a link from somebody they don't know and opens a malicious attachment, That's something that really kind of falls in the human error space, right? And so even the very best technology is not going to prevent human error. And so that's why lots of companies invest time and energy in training their staff around, you know, these are the risks to be aware of. Sometimes it is truly a gap in software. You'll hear about cyber incidents that happened because somebody had unpatched software. There were software updates available for a particular program. Maybe it was on a website, maybe it was on a server, and the cyber criminals were able to find that unpatched software and go straight into a network that way without having to go through sort of human credentials, if you will. And sometimes it is a hardware problem. There, for example, you know, somebody loses a cell phone that's not password protected or leaves a laptop on a train seat, even though none of us have been traveling quite as much the past year. So information can be lost that way as well. And sometimes not only do hackers get what's on that device, but sometimes on that device they find information that lets them log into a bigger network. So it happens in a lot of different ways. And this is what makes it so complicated to defend against. Because hackers only have to find one way in, right?
They manage. Yeah. Has the last year and a half of COVID made it even more difficult for these companies, government agencies, individuals to actually protect themselves for some reason?
It really has, especially at the start of COVID, because we very quickly had a whole lot of people who traditionally worked in offices pivot to working from home. And without necessarily having company provided laptops or computers or phones, and without necessarily having any policies or specific guidance from those organizations around how to safely handle information. So the switch to working from home has certainly created increased vulnerability. If I'm sitting in an office and I'm logged into my organization's IT network, there might be all kinds of additional firewalls and safeguards and, you know, intrusion monitoring that I don't have sitting on my home Wi-Fi network. So especially, again, in the early phases of COVID, as everybody was trying to quickly pivot to have office workers working from home, there was heightened risk. There's lots that can be done to defend against it, but it's that combination of training users what risks to look for, having sensible policies in place around passwords and multi-factor authentication, and using secure VPN tunnels to log into organizational networks, all those kind of things.
More of my conversation with April Falcon-Doss when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with April Falcon-Doss. She's Executive Director of the Institute for Technology Law and Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center. If, let's say, Russia, China are involved, would people at the highest level of government know about that kind of hacking of major systems in this country?
Well, let's hope so. And the short answer is it depends, because it's such a hard thing to get a view of. So agencies like the NSA can look externally and see whether or not they see activities overseas that look like they are cyber attacks heading this way. Agencies like the FBI can look within the U.S. for evidence of cyber crimes. Agencies like DHS talk all the time to the private sector around what they're seeing, both what government's seeing and what the private sector is seeing. But in terms of who detects it first, it really varies. So, for example, the SolarWinds attack a few months ago was first announced by a private cybersecurity company that detected it in their monitoring. And this is becoming increasingly common because, you know, there's really good reasons why we don't want the government monitoring our internet, right? So where there are private sector companies that have lots and lots of customers all over the world that they're doing cyber intrusion monitoring for, sometimes it's those threat researchers, it's Mandiant or one of these other cyber companies that actually sees it first because they're seeing so many inputs from their customers and they can alert the government. So there's no question that the Biden administration is paying an enormous amount of attention to this. Who sees the first indications of an attack can really vary.
The question becomes whether a leader like Putin knows who the hackers are in his country and exactly what they're doing.
It's widely believed that cyber criminals would not be able to operate in Russia without at least tacit approval from Putin. And, you know, exactly what level of detail of information he has, personally, you know, who knows, but within the Kremlin, certainly is there awareness? Almost certainly. And, you know, the extent to which some of the other sort of major cyber adversaries, China, Iran, North Korea, might be doing similar things, you know, these are certainly questions absolutely that the government is looking at. And it's interesting, in the U.S., we tend to look at cyber issues in different buckets or kind of different categories. There's defending against cyber attacks, there's gathering intelligence, there's online disinformation and amplification of conspiracy theories. We kind of look at those as being different problems that we tackle using different agencies and different approaches. In a country like Russia, it is viewed much more holistically, really. These are all tools for the projection of power in the geopolitical stage. So although within the Russian intelligence services, there is certainly some specialization in terms of who does what kind of cyber operations, whether it's a disinformation campaign directed at a Western election or exfiltration of data from the U.S. defense industry, or ransomware attacks, it's all part of the same bundle of tools.
President Biden is said to raise this issue when he meets with Mr. Putin. The question is what kind of response he's likely to get and what kinds of threats President Biden can state that could put a halt or even a pause to this kind of activity, at least on the part of Russia. And we're singling out Russia here, but as you said, many other nation states may be involved.
So first, I should say, I give the Biden administration really high marks for how they're tackling cyber issues. They really are approaching it as a matter of great urgency and importance and taking a multi-pronged approach internally within government that I think is really well advised. In terms of the discussion with Putin, I think the really important thing is going to be making clear that these cyber attacks in all of their forms are not only not acceptable to the U.S., but the U.S. is willing to invoke the full range of diplomatic and other measures that are available to it to counter these. So are there responsive cyber actions that could be taken? Certainly. I mean, there's a U.S. Cyber Command, and I suspect that probably some part of the conversation will be President Biden saying, you know, we have some really good hackers too, and we can do some damage if we choose. So be mindful of what lines you cross, because I'm willing to take some direct action. Certainly, though, there's lots of responses available outside the cyber tools realm. And so that includes things like economic sanctions against organizations and individuals in Russia. It includes diplomatic pressure in all the traditional forms. It includes economic pressure that is distinct from sanctions, but in the context of trade agreements on the multilateral stage. I mean, sort of, again, all these tools of power, I think, are the things that will likely be brought to bear because it's really the only way to, I think, address it.
And one of which you mentioned certainly implies that perhaps even the U.S. government is involved in cyber espionage.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the U.S. intelligence community absolutely has intelligence gathering capabilities, and some of those are carried out by cyber means. Every major power in the world does. What's really interesting about this handful of more aggressive cyber actors, like Russia, like China, like Iran, is that they have moved beyond what is considered sort of within the realm of traditional intelligence. You know, cyber espionage, if you will, is just sort of another kind of way of getting at the plans and intentions of foreign governments, right? I mean, governments have been spying on each other since time immemorial, and cyber means are one way to do it. But stepping beyond that to theft of intellectual property for commercial benefit of state-owned companies, or stepping beyond that to try to influence elections in other nations, or to sort of inflict economic pain through things like cyber crime, those things really do fall outside the traditional scope of espionage.
But are there individual actors here in the U.S. who are doing the same thing to companies outside this country that the FBI, the Justice Department, may or may not know about that are happening under our own noses?
Yes, so there certainly are cyber criminals in the U.S. as well. And what's interesting is that different countries have different reputations in terms of how aggressively they enforce cybercrime and how willing they are to turn a blind eye. So by and large, cyber criminals that are able to operate outside the U.S. prefer to be outside the U.S. because they don't want to get caught. But absolutely, there are criminals in the U.S. as well, and the FBI investigates and prosecutes them just as it would overseas criminal actors.
Now, with the recovery of the money by FBI, or a large part of the ransom that was paid, do you think that that will actually temper the ambitions, at least temporarily, of those who are seeking to use ransomware to shut down corporations or major companies in this country?
Well, it's certainly gotten their attention. Whether or not it will temper their enthusiasm, I think, is going to depend on whether this is repeatable. So if you think back when we were talking a few minutes ago about how cryptocurrency works and the importance of that private key, if you don't have the private key, you can't access the funds. If the FBI obtains the private key essentially through a series of happy coincidences, right? However that was, you know, a tip from an informant or somebody being, one of the criminals being careless with it, right? It might not be repeatable, in which case it's unlikely to have any long-lasting effect on trends in ransomware. However, although the FBI is not saying exactly how they did it, they are certainly implying that it's repeatable, that whatever techniques they used, they think can be used again. If we see over the next 6 months to a year some additional instances in which this happened, if you take away the profit motive, or at least diminish the profit motive, there's less reason to do this. Unfortunately, for cyber criminals who are outside the U.S., it remains a relatively low-risk thing to do, because if they are in a country that is sort of hospitable to cybercrime, there is a relatively low likelihood that they will ever get arrested. Sometimes you see somebody was picked up on a beach in Spain while they were on vacation, and they've been arrested and hauled off to jail in the U.S. or in Europe on cybercrime charges. But it does remain relatively low risk if the criminals are operating in a country that takes a lax enforcement approach. So even the diminished financial incentive won't be enough to bring cybercrime to a halt. But again, if the FBI can repeat this success, it will certainly be catching everybody's attention.
FBI Director Christopher Wray compared the threat to 9/11. Do you agree with that statement?
It's a bit of apples and oranges, isn't it? I mean, since we had such a dramatic and tragic loss of life on 9/11, and thankfully we have not seen loss of life from cyber attacks. It is certainly possible that we could. We know that there are cyber actors who are focused on things like gaining access to infrastructure in ways that would allow them to do things like open the floodgates of a dam or shut down an electric grid. So certainly there are cyber attacks that could result in loss of life. So in terms of where the comparison, I think, is a really apt one, is that when 9/11 happened, the U.S. security establishment recognized that it really needed to try to take a holistic view of all the potential tools of government to identify potential terrorist actors and counter those threats. And, you know, people argue about whether the steps taken were the right ones or not, but there was very much a recognition that the threat from international terrorism had to be addressed in ways that were different than just dealing with, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of another nation, right? That military intelligence and foreign policy were different challenges. So I think what we're seeing is the recognition that cyber risk rises to that same level of severity in terms of its potential impact, and like the problem of international terrorism, really requires the government to think differently about how it approaches it. Because the approaches that have worked for some of these other national security challenges aren't going to be enough by themselves to tackle this set of problems.
So what kinds of changes do you believe are absolutely necessary for not only the government to make, but for private corporations to make?
So I think it's a combination of things. We have seen the administration take some very good first steps. They have, within the national security staff, a senior cyber advisor. We have the newly nominated national cyber director, a position that was authorized by Congress to help set cyber policy both within the federal government and in making recommendations to the public. All of the things that the government is doing are certainly heading down the right path. We have the cyber executive order that requires U.S. government agencies to sort of up their cyber game. We have a ransomware task force coming out of DOJ. Lots of good things. However, the private sector really is really challenged in how to deal with this. Because if you think about it, the private sector includes you and me on this call, right? There are big companies and big nonprofit organizations that have really well-staffed and resourced IT departments that have a really good understanding of how to manage these risks, that can train their people, that can update their software, and are fairly well able to protect themselves. But there are lots and lots and lots of small businesses and individuals who don't have those resources and that know-how. So one of the really important roles for the federal government to expand on is providing the education resources, the guidance, the recommendations that are adaptable not just by big financial services companies or big healthcare systems, but by a local doctor's office or by a local restaurant. Because what happens all too often and is really kind of heartbreaking on a day-to-day basis is seeing small businesses get hit with a cyber attack that has the potential to wipe them out. And the government has both the knowledge and the capacity to make more guidance and education available to help private sector individuals and small entities be better prepared.
I understand that the CEO of Colonial Pipeline is testifying before Congress today. What do you expect to hear?
I expect that he will probably talk in part about this really difficult decision that companies have to make around whether to pay a ransom or not. The FBI has long recommended against paying ransom on the theory that if you pay ransom, it encourages future cybercrime.
Right.
On the flip side, if you're a healthcare system, if you're a pipeline operator, if you're a small mom and pop shop, right? If the only way to get your systems back online in a quick and timely manner is to pay the ransom, then the immediate concerns may be more important in that decision for that business owner. So it really is a difficult situation. And cyber experts always advise people and companies, have backups for your data, have other ways to access it so that if you get hit with one of these attacks, you don't have to pay the ransomware. That's absolutely a best practice. And it's also true that not everybody has that in place. And sometimes even if it's in place, sometimes it would take an unacceptably long time to restore data from backups, or sometimes the backups haven't been tested recently and they're not as robust as they thought. It really is a difficult set of challenges. So is the best thing to be prepared and try to prevent an attack and be able to recover without paying? Sure, that's always best. But we're not living in that ideal cyber world. And so very often companies find themselves facing that conundrum of whether to pay or not. So I expect we'll hear from the Colonial Pipeline CEO about that.
What's your own view?
My own view is that it is perfectly reasonable for those private sector entities, companies, nonprofits, whoever it is, to make that decision based on their own balancing of all the factors that are involved. For example, if a doctor's office is hit with a ransomware attack and they can't access patient records, that could compromise patient care, right? They might still be able to see patients, but might not be able to see the patient's full history. So in that case, is it more important to get the records accessible again quickly? Maybe it is, and if ransom is the way to do that, maybe that's the more important set of equities, right? So it's very case-specific in my view.
You know, I was thinking about Neiman Marcus, which got hit, and thinking about all the information about clients who have charge accounts.
Most Americans have now had their personal information compromised, either, you know, through one of the data breaches that hit companies like Target or Home Depot, or the OPM data breach, or through the Equifax data breach, right? And some of the things that individuals can do to protect themselves a bit are being really cautious to not use the same password for lots of different accounts.
Right.
Because if one site gets hacked, if you had an account on Yahoo at the time of the Yahoo data breach, and that same password was one you used for your banking and your online shopping accounts, and right, then you have to change the password across all those other services. Because the hackers who saw the data breach from the Yahoo data can get into your other accounts. So there's simple things like that, like using multi-factor authentication so that somebody can't log in from another device to your accounts without you being notified. And you can say, oh, wait a minute, that doesn't look right. I'm not going to approve that. So there are steps that people can take, again, both individuals and, you know, organizations, to help mitigate these risks. Unfortunately, right now, it is just such big and lucrative business for the cyber criminals that it is really hard to stay ahead of.
April, this has been absolutely fascinating and so instructive. Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Despite all the doom and gloom, it is not all bad news, and I would not recommend that people just throw up their hands and say, oh, what's the use? I sometimes hear people say, well, if Russia or China really wants my data, what can I do to stop them? That's a fair point, but for most of us, Russia and China aren't trying to get our data, right? So the simple things that we can do actually can provide us with a lot of protection. Just like you wouldn't, you know, if you park your car in a parking lot, you're not going to leave the window down and the wallet on the front seat. Right? If you have something valuable, you might put it in the glove box, lock the glove box, roll up the window, lock the car, right? If you do the equivalent of those things, it makes you less vulnerable. Doesn't remove the risk altogether, but those things can make a real positive difference.
April, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Diane. It's been such a pleasure.
That was April Falcon-Doss, Executive Director of the Institute for Technology and Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.